The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
But just to take a brief sitting spell, first of all, just to give you an overview of Masada, right? So, up there is Herod's palace, and that is here. See how there's much more thick structure here? This is Herod's palace, okay? Along the walls, they built these homes. Obviously, they built them on the walls because they were able to use one wall of Herod and save themselves the building, okay? This is the southern tip. This is where we're going to end up. In the middle, you'll see there's like a Byzantine structure. That's that monastery that was up here in the 4th, 5th century. Okay? You'll see the southern palace of Herod. He had two palaces. Up there is the second one. Okay? And you'll see the structure of that palace over here. And we'll talk about that a little bit. Okay? We're going to take a walk up to the palace. I've just learned from experience there's a value to taking 2 minutes to sit and see if anybody has any questions. I said there's a legend that they're reincarnated souls. I have no idea. No, that's an important difference. Look, I want to tell you something. It's a good question. It's a heavy question. We're coming to this place, this site of mass suicide. Why are we glorifying this? Right? So I'll tell you three things. First of all, halakhically speaking, from a purely technical perspective, you're absolutely right. Technically, halakhically, Judaism does not believe in suicide. To the extreme, by the way. The reason Judaism does not believe in suicide is really quite simple. It's because the life that we're choosing to take is not really ours. You know, we live with this illusion, okay? We think that we're like, you know, it's my life, I can do with it what I want. Judaism doesn't believe that's true. Judaism believes that I'm created for a purpose. It's a gift. And it's like any other gift. Right, if I give my son a sports car and he uses it to plow through shopping malls, so then he doesn't deserve the gift. That's the technical dry halacha. However, that does not mean that I have the right to judge someone who does take suicide. Right? I can judge the action. I don't have a right to judge the person. You know, like that whole famous case that was recently in the news. What was her name? Terishan. Vegetable. We don't know whether she's conscious or not conscious, suffering or not suffering. I hear both sides of the coin. I'm very envious of people who absolutely know that they know the opinion. Very difficult question. Now you get back to this. So if you ask me dryly, technically, halakhically, would the rabbis have approved of such a thing? No. Maybe that's why it never made it into the Talmud. But neither was it denigrated in the Talmud. It was one more chapter of the tragedy of the Jewish people. Now, just as an aside, when you struggle with this question, this is the same choiceless choice as we saw at Yad Vashem. You know, imagine that you're up here, and I have 4 children. And imagine that I make it here, and I fight, and whatever. And who knows, maybe I'm a reincarnated soul from one of these guys. I have no idea. And now the day's coming. They've built a ramp, they're breaking through, they're going to be up here tomorrow morning. And I look at my children. Shalom Nidah, we should never know some such things, B'li'ah Nidah. You know, when you look at a deen, you look at Yair, and you know what the Romans are going to do to Yair. They're not just going to, they're going to rip off his limbs. They're going to, could you imagine such a thing? Could you live with yourself? And by the way, they won't separate you so that you only imagine. They'll make you watch because they want to destroy you. And because they've been sitting out here for over a year and a half, miserable in this desert, and they're going to take it out on you. They're not just going to take your daughter off as a slave, they're going to separate you from her. So that for the rest of your life, you're going to spend every day wondering what they're doing to your daughter. And first, before they separate you, they'll show you what they do to her. I'd like to believe that I have the strength to have decided not to take suicide. I'd like to believe that if we had survived, that some of those children would have given birth to Jews and they would be part of the Jewish people today. I have no idea. I also believe that that was the destiny of these particular people and these particular souls. And that's what they're meant to do for other reasons I can't understand. So I can technically tell you, if you ask me halakhically, whether we should commit suicide, no. If I was standing in an army base, And we were faced, we were surrounded by the Syrians. And this was something that absolutely faced Jewish soldiers in the Yom Kippur War, surrounded by Syrian commanders, and I'm going to tell you a story about that tomorrow. They took a different choice. They did not commit suicide. And the reason they did not commit suicide was the same reason that we were brought up here, to be sworn in as soldiers to the Israeli army, because the principle of this place, you know, I gotta explain this to you. We come up here, and, you know, the snake bath you just saw, right? So imagine getting to that snake bath, not off an air-conditioned bus, but getting to that snake bath in the desert over there, after a 10-mile run, okay? With open stretchers the last mile, okay? And you get to the bottom here, and you can't move, about 10 o'clock in the morning. You're under Mishmat Mayim, which means that every hour you have to drink an entire canteen of water. So they stop you at the bottom and they make you drink a whole canteen of water. And then they say, okay, now we're going to run up the snake bath. On a full canteen of water, after running, you know, for God knows, 2.5 hours. So we're running up the snake bath. You can't run up the snake bath. You, like, instead of going like this, you go like this. And it's like, we get to the top, they make us open stretchers. Now, thank God, I was praying they wouldn't put me on top of one of the stretchers. Okay, because even though it's easier, because the other one's carrying the stretcher, to be up on a stretcher going up the snake bath is sick. These guys were terrified. I mean, what if we dropped them, right? Anyway, we get up to almost the top, and our commander yells, Nu yala tashiru, start to sing! So we see the top, right? And he says, you know, sing! So we were his denikin, we were like religious guys, we start singing and niggin. You know, yamze, mechuba, singing Shabbos song. We get up to the top, we think we're done. Then he makes us round this whole mountain. He says, Ani rotze shiru kula mize ashirion. I want everybody to see who the Armored Corps is. And then he teaches us the motto of the Armored Corps. You know the motto of the Armored Corps is? Metzada lo tipol shuv. Metzada will not fall again. What they went through, we will make sure never to allow to be repeated. That's the theme of the birth of the State of Israel. There will not be another Metzada. This state exists so that no Jew anywhere should have to face such a choice as his place to go. So I think that's why we come here. We come here because 2,000 years ago, these Jews faced overwhelming odds and they refused to give up. Now in a way, suicide is a refusal to give in. It's not a refusal to give up, but it's a refusal to give in. And while I can't judge it, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but I would never presume to pretend that I can know what I would do in their stead. Okay? Come, follow me. We're going to go up to Herod's palace now. Try to stay close, okay guys? Come. So just really quickly, I'm only going to stop here for a second because it's shady. Somebody asked me, so what'd they do? How'd they build all these buildings? They quarried them. Now, for the palace of King Herod, they quarried them. Now, Herod, this was no problem. Because Herod had a very sophisticated system of quarrying. It was a three-finger system. You ready? It goes like this. Right? You know? Let's quarry some stone. The rebels, though, I mean, imagine this. And if you can't imagine it, stand in the sun for a minute. You know? You're working down there. There's no bulldozers. There's no electric drill. You're quarrying these with your hands. Then you've got to shape them into stone, and you've got to put them up, and you've got to mud them down. It's an amazing amount of work. Amazing amount of work. And they've got this palace here. Why are they quarrying all the stone to build casement walls all around the mountain? Stick with this question and follow me. And you see where Arya is standing? So they discovered, I'm just going to tell you this here, okay? First of all, this was the house of the commander of the garrison that held Herod's palace. You're now entering a more closed military zone. And where Arya is standing on the side is a villa, which we'll take a look after I give you an explanation. Come here. Normally I go in there first. We'll go in there. I'm going to give you a second to go in there afterwards. That is a villa. Picture now, you've just entered the palace. Remember over there I showed you the whole hill of Masada? And I showed you that on the northern tip there's this palace? That's this. Okay? We've just entered here. Okay? This is the southern side, south, north, west, northwest towards Jerusalem. Okay? East, behind me, Jordan. Okay? This is the northern palace. Now look, that in the day, okay, on this side, it's much cooler. Because the sun hangs in the south later, right? That's why the palace is here. These are all the storehouses where he stored his stuff. We're going to walk through them. You can see them here. Each one of these storehouses held something else: oil, olives, grain, dried fruits, weapons, arrowheads, arms, ballistica, everything. Unbelievable, the amount of material that they found up here. You look at the luxury in which they lived. The more you get in, the more privileged you were. So this is like if you were a guest, but you know, you were like the assistant to the lieutenant governor of New York. So maybe when you're in Albany, people know who you are. But when you come to Washington, you're, right? But still, you know, on the list, you're the assistant lieutenant governor. So the king is going to think, like, what do I lose by giving the guy a nice day? You never know. So they put him, like, here. In there. He had a little villa. But he's not in the palace. He's not hanging out with the baths and the whole geschäft. Okay? So that's like you and me, Joe Schlepper. Okay? And you'll take a look. They found an original fresco still on the wall. You will notice, by the way, that there's a black line along much of the stone here. You'll see it in there. You saw it where we were standing. You'll see it in the storehouses. The black line represents something very simple. When Yigal Yadin came up here, started to dig down, what they found, exactly as it was, is everything below the black line. What they reconstructed from how the stones fell and what they knew about archaeology is what's on top of the black line. So, for example, if you look over there, okay, you'll see that below the black line, that's all they found. They were able to reconstruct it. If you find a pile of stones next to a wall, you know those stones came from the wall. Today, actually, they do it much more accurately. In fact, there's a project underway in certain archaeological sites to redo it. They take a photo of the, a computer photo, an image, of the pile that they find, the structure that they know, and the computer reprocesses what must have happened, how it fell down, and is able to number the stones, and you can put them back exactly as they were. It's amazing. Unfortunately, it costs a tremendous amount of money. So I'd rather have the house a little bit off and feed the orphans, but, you know, that's just me, right? But anyway, notice something else. Notice that you're entering a fortress, okay? This is a wall. We just walked through here. Look at how narrow that wall is over here. Okay, it's a narrow entryway. You see that big square over there? That is the highest point on Mitzada. That is the guard tower. From there, in Herod's palace, if they ever manage to storm the mountain, he's got a fort up here to hold them off. Okay? And you don't just come in. You have to come in and go around and come in. We're going to talk about this in the Golan. Anybody who went in the Jaffa Gate, notice that the Jaffa Gate doesn't go like this, straight through. It's like this. Zion Gate, same thing. They built gates this way because if an enemy is storming in, they all of a sudden have to stop and turn. And that's a bottleneck. And because you know they're going to slow down there, that's the place you can hit them. Right? It's a defensive measure. I'm going to show you tomorrow in the Golan that we still do this today as a modern army. That's exactly what Herod does. Now what that means is that this is a very lonely place. Because this is where, if it happens, it's going to happen. And I'll explain this to you in a second. Take a look at the storehouses as we walk along. Remember I told you the story of the student who tried on a dare a dry date? Okay, that was here. Mamash found food here and ate it. Still edible, because it's so dry up here. Okay? Which reminds me, anybody want to take?
Drink.
Take a drink. Everybody take a drink. Okay?
This huge fortress that they had.
Oh, good question. Now that you have a chance to see the luxury up here, why didn't the Jews, I mean, look at this place. This is the fortress. There were buildings, there are bathhouses, villas. Why not live here? Why build all those casement walls? I'll tell you my theory. And I think archaeologists share this theory. There are different opinions, though. But I'll tell you what I believe. Imagine that you're a fighter from the Warsaw Ghetto, Vilna Ghetto, Lodz Ghetto, and you escape. And you figure you'll outfox the enemy, and you head deeper into the enemy territory, into Germany. And maybe you're in the Black Forest, and you come across an SS lair, Berchtesgaden, which was one of Hitler's escape palaces in the Black Forest. And you come across this place, built by the Nazis, for Adolf Hitler, and it's got Turkish baths. It's got a sauna. It's got luxurious beds. And your cousins are being murdered in Auschwitz. Could you sleep in Hitler's comfortable bed? Could you sit in the jacuzzi knowing the Jews are dying? You probably wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. I know Jews to this day who not only will not buy, but will not ride in a Volkswagen. Because the Volkswagen, the people's wagon, was the wagon of Adolf Hitler. I think when the Jews came up here, we don't appreciate this. Rome was Nazi Germany. Rome took children and threw them off the edges of the walls. Rome butchered, Rome raped, Rome pillaged. So you come up here and you find this. Could you live here? Do you want to bring up your... They don't know that this is going to be a 2.5-year story. They think they're building a city here. Could you bring up your children to live in Roman dwelling places? Couldn't do it. I think that's why they built that. I think what's interesting is the educational value. You come up here, you're a community. What do you do all day? What do you do all day? There are two things they did. The other thing we'll talk about at the end of the tour. People need something to do. I want my kids busy. So they had school. And they learned. They learned Torah. We found the base members where they learned. And they built. What if you get a kid and he's like a little ADD? He's just not the one to sit on the books. He can be part of the building project. So they built all these casement walls. And these kids grew up with a work ethic. Something very powerful about what was going on this mountain. Okay? So if you want, what we're going to do, you see those two fellas, see those people with the orange hats? We're going to meet right there against the wall in the shade. Take a look in the villa without disturbing that group. Not such a big deal to see, but, you know, in case anybody wants to take a look. And we're going to meet around the corner. Hopefully there'll be a little shade left on the wall. This represented Roman luxury.
Okay. It's
this represented everything they were fighting against. They weren't just fighting against tyranny. They were also fighting against the way of life. Okay. Now, the Romans believed, right? You know, now look at the difference between this building and the little casement house that we were in before. This is an original fresco that has been restored that's 2,000 years old. The whole wall was like this. I mean, it was beautiful. And it's cool. This is a replica. In fact, really, there used to be, it came down because too many groups came through here. Right over there at the edge of the cement was a third one of these. Okay? And that's how the breeze would come through, but it would protect you from the sun. So this was like luxury. And this is just the edge. This is before you get to the palace. So you could understand how the rebels would not want to live in here. Come. I mean, Herod was a paranoid, but here, stand against the walls, you get some shade. He was a paranoid, and he butchered 30,000 Jews. He wasn't a convert. He was not Jewish. He was the son of an Edomite woman. All right, just a real quick thought. They didn't live here. But I'm willing to bet they were brilliant tacticians. Elazar ben Yair, who was their commander, understood the psychology of warfare on so many different levels. When we're in the shade, I'll explain you why. Now, if I was a commander, and I came up here once, and I spent the day here, not for the archaeology, I wanted to take a military look at this place. And I tried to put myself in the headspace with all the stuff that I've learned in, you know, officer's course, sergeant's course, commander's course, whatever. And one thing I'm sure of, if I was commanding the garrison of Jews that were up here, fighting the Romans, I would assume the worst, because that's just how you create a strategy. And the worst would be that they came up here and overran the place. And I would assume that in the event that they did come up here, the best strategic place to hold them off was here. Herod's fortress. Now, when I was back in Yeshiva after the army, you were in my yeshiva yesterday, so, you know, you may have noticed that there was a guard post up on the open plaza, and there's a guard at the gate, you know. There are security considerations in a place like that. So they have one yeshiva student, it's always an officer, who takes overall command of the yeshiva from a security position. So they asked me 1 year to do it. So for a year I was in charge of like the security of the yeshiva. Now I realized that you have basically 600 guys, 700 guys. They're all soldiers. So you basically find yourself in command, and I didn't realize this when I took this on. You basically find yourself in command of like a couple of battalions. It's a pretty overwhelming experience, and you're not trying to learn and prepare for rabbinical school and whatever else. One of the things that you have to do is you have to decide, you know, sort of what to do in the event of emergencies. And you do a couple of drills over the course of the year, and one of the drills that you do is in the event that there's a terrorist attack and all the guys are in the base members. And what you do is, you know, there's a whole system. You have 15 guys, I've actually changed the system, you have 15 guys who actually have to bring their guns with them to learning, and they're sitting in the base members. And you pick them according to where they sit. And they have, everybody else is hitting the dirt, because it's always safer on the ground in a terrorist event, because bullets don't naturally fly along the ground, right? So you're safer. And, but these 15 guys, their job is not to hit the dirt, but to run to a position, to every doorway, to every window, whatever it might be. And you practice this a couple times. Now I imagine that if you're living up here, you do the same thing. You've got women, you've got children, you've got to tell them what to do. So you train them. In the event of X, Y, and Z, everybody will make for the fortress. And I'll bet you practice it. And I'll bet they had a shofar, which we know they did because we found the shofar from up here. And I'm sure they didn't only use it for Rosh Hashanah, because we know that from historical writings. And I'm sure that, you know, maybe once a month they blew the shofar and they had the Romans are coming drill. Someone would get up on the walls and yell, the Romans are coming, the Romans are coming. And they would probably tell you which side they were coming from, and then they would all run here. Now picture this scene. We also know that there was a guard position on the northern tip, which makes a lot of sense. You'll see why in a second. And, you know, Jews, you know, would come here and they would do guard duty while they were up here for those 2.5 years. So now imagine the Shabbos afternoon. I remember when we first moved to Efrat, and Mayim was just born, and at the beginning we all had to do guard duty. Eventually, you know, it was too big for that, and they hired a chevron, and everybody pays a guard tax, like, you know, 50, 100 shekels a year, and they have guards that are professional, which is better. But at the beginning, you know, there were only a couple hundred families, and we all took turns doing guard duty. So I remember one Shabbos afternoon I was doing guard duty on the edge of Efrat, and Dorit surprised me. You know, she knew where I was. It was depressing to do guard duty in Shabbos afternoon. She brought my own stroller, and she brought some, like, you know, grapes and cake and whatever. And she came to find me, and she, like, kept me company. And guard duty was amazing, you know. It was such a nice experience. So if you're up on Masada and it's Shabbos, what do you have to do? So you're married, and you've got a couple of little kids. They had children up here. And your husband's doing guard duty up there. So you figure, okay, I'll walk the kids over, and we'll go visit Abba. He's on guard duty. And then you get to this spot. These walls are the natural defending point of this fortress. If I was creating a defensive position, I would put a couple guys up on top of this tower. And that would be their job. I'm not even sure I wouldn't create a position so they could just fall into it, just like there were weapons over there. Maybe boiling oil. Maybe archers. We know they had archers. I'll get to that in the shade. And now you're a woman and you're walking with your 2 children and you're surrounded by 3 legions and things do not look good. I wonder if you can help your mind going here. Or if you walk down this path and you wonder, is this where it's going to end? Will I one day be running with my children or Roman legionnaires are trying to catch up with me? This must have been a very lonely walk. We don't think of it from the personal perspective. What do you say to your child who's 6 or 7, right? You met Yair yesterday. Lots of questions. What do you say to Yair when he looks down the mountain and he sees 15,000 Roman soldiers? What are they doing down there, Abba? What do they want? Should we go down and give them a present? How do you explain to your child that there are 3 full legions that are dedicated to your destruction? And why can't you go visit anywhere? Never mind post the destruction of the base of Mikdash and what happened to Grandma and Grandpa. Gives you a sense of what really went on here, you know? Pardon?
I guess we were surrounded on all sides.
All sides. You'll see that in a second. You will see in one more second. We're walking through a storeroom here, and the entire area on both sides is the continuous storerooms. This is the original material that these storerooms were made. This covered it to prevent moisture escaping and entering. And it's how they stored things. I mean, this was literally a full, it's like a pool of something. So it wasn't just rock, it was, you know. You get a sense of all these storerooms. Right? How much they must have been here. This is actually the entrance. This is not a storeroom. The storerooms are on either side. This is how you got in. See how it's like more of a fortress. Now you're deeper in. You're going to get a movie. Don't get that movie. Get the movie called Masada. It stars Peter O'Toole. It's a 2-cassette. It's like 5 hours. And it's amazing. Amazing. Okay, hang on 1 second. Look from here. You can sort of get a sense of the storerooms. Those are actually the baths. We'll take a look at that on our way out. These were the steps leading up to the inner palace of Herod. These are reconstructed to give you an idea, and those are the original steps. If you made it this far, you were a privileged visitor. Come. Drink, people. Okay, line yourselves up here facing this way. So first of all, you see, down to your left, another one of the Roman camps. The Romans built a ring of camps around the mountain so that the Jews would know that each camp was in view of another camp. So you couldn't attack one camp because the other camps would see you and you would be decimated. The most fascinating part of this is what you see down below. Do you see there's like a line of rocks? Very distinct line. See what I'm talking about? You know, a few hundred yards down, it leads up to that fortress. Okay? So if you look carefully, that line goes around the whole base of the mountain. And I'll tell you what that line was. That was a siege wall. Okay? They estimate that it was probably about 8 meters high. That's 25 feet. Everywhere you see a little pile, see how there are piles in some areas? They want to rebuild the wall, but that's a lot of money, so they've never gotten the money for it. Each of those piles, they think, was actually a guard tower. Guard towers. It's built just far enough out, so that if somebody comes down off the mountain and tries to escape, he has to go through all this no man's land. They'll catch him. Each guard tower is within sight of the guard towers on either side, which means you have two or three watchmen who are looking at the mountain at all times. At a certain point, the silver realizes he's not going to take this mountain by frontal assault. So he builds a siege wall. Takes him almost a year. One morning you wake up, and the Romans are building. And if you're a Jewish defender, when the Romans are building, you get nervous. I wonder how long it took them. A day? A week? A month? Until they realized what the Romans were doing. They were building a wall. Home had just become a prison. And I'll bet one morning you woke up and you realized it was no longer a question of whether, it was just a question of when. Notice also that siege wall is built out far enough that the archers who were up here couldn't reach it. Otherwise they would just shoot arrows down onto the wall when they were building it. By the way, down below on your left, you can see part of, I'm going to show you it from up top in a second, you can see part of the hanging palace of King Herod. The lower down you got, the more privileged you were. Herod's personal quarters are the lowest level, okay, which is sort of just beyond what you're looking at. And we don't have time to get down there, as much as it looks like it's just a second. There's only one path down on the other side of the mountain. It takes a good 5 minutes, 10 minutes to get down there, a good 20 minutes to get back up. And for Herodian architecture, I think you can come back on your own. But I will tell you that it is an experience worth having. It's interesting.
Why did he live low, Dad?
Pardon?
You know why he lived low?
Yeah, because that was the coolest place on the mountain, and it was also the best protected. This is actually a viewpoint. This is more villas and more housing, the inner garrison, the privileged guests. This is the upper level of the palace. Okay? If you want to take a look at what the outside of the palace looked like, first come over here and see it from on top. Alright? And then you can look at the model if you want. But before you go over there, come over here. Look down the side of the mountain. Can you see? That's the mid-level. Now take a look at this book if you want to know what you're looking at. See this book here? Yeah, they're close. See this book? This is a close-up picture of what you're on top of. And this is what they think it actually looked like. See?
Wow.
Cool?
We're up at the top level here?
Right. This is what it looks like today, and this is what they think it looked like then. See? Cool, huh? This is, by the way, a magnificent book. Yeah, you can take a look at the book. This is, they take all the archaeological structures. For example, this is Jerusalem today. This is Yerushalayim today. And this is what they think it looked like, Ir David, back then.
Oh,
see?
Oh, that is cool.
Based on archaeology. This is the lower level of Ir David, okay, where some of you went with Matel, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is what they think it looked like back then.
Do they
cool,
have that book in English?
You can buy it. I think you might be able to buy it in the gift store, but you can buy it in any major bookstore. See if there's another one. There are starlings that come up here. But, and there are pigeons sometimes, but most of them are either ravens or blackbirds. Pardon? No, this is actually, if you look on your left, first of all, look very clearly. You can see how the siege wall here goes up to the cliff, stops, and then resumes at the top of the cliff. They were determined that these Jews should not escape. You can see one of the larger base camps with an inner command center inside over here. De Silva eventually moved his camp here. That's one theory. You can also see the, there's a sound and light show. You can come here. You can't get here from the Dead Sea. You have to either walk in, which is a major seaport. You have to basically take a transportation via Arad. It's a long way to go, but it's worth it. It's about an hour from here. So go all the way around, because there's no road through, for obvious reasons, archaeologically. And at night, pardon? Oh, that's interesting. That's military. That's a maneuver. That's a targil. They're practicing something. See the helicopters?
Two of them, actually.
Yeah. They're doing a maneuver. One of them is landing.
The Roman army.
Yeah, I'll tell you what that might be, although I could be wrong. That actually might be a rescue mission. There might be some metalim. Today's a very hot day. If it's any consolation, I actually asked down below, because I was curious, and you're not allowed to walk up the snake path today. It's too hot.
Oh.
So it's like 45 degrees today, which is like 96, 97. Good. You don't feel 96, 97, right? Because it's dry.
Right.
So people do tealing. They do hikes. And sometimes people get stranded or they break a leg or something and they're stuck.
Okay.
So usually they call in a special unit from the Army, which is a rescue mission unit, and they'll come in and pull people out. That may be what that is. Maybe. It also might be just a regular landing maneuver. It also might be that they've dropped soldiers to do navigations into the desert. Yeah, that's the dust from the helicopter cloud. Yeah, there's two of them. So you can come here at night. I think it's like three nights a week. And you can call any of the hotels in the Dead Sea. They'll tell you when it is. And you pay your whatever it is, $10, and you see the show. It's an amazing show. It's a depiction of the story of Masada.
Wow.
With voices in the desert that ring out against the desert, and music, classical music, regular music, and lights and lasers that come up against the mountain. It's incredible. It's cool. And they have a good snack bar. One last thing, and then we're going to move, because I want this group to be able to talk. Can you hear me? One last thing. If you look over here, okay, you'll see there's a ramp that goes up to the side of the mountain. You can see very clearly the Roman ramp. Okay? And I'm going to talk to you about that in a couple minutes. Okay? The Roman ramp. You see that? It's right over there. It goes right up. It's like a ridge, but that's man-made. That was built by the Romans. It didn't exist.
All that dirt.
All that dirt. We'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, come follow me. We're going to walk back the way we came. Guys, keep it down just while we pass the group so we don't bother them. Give me one sec. Now look at this floor. This is actually an original floor that dates back to the time of King Herod. This is the bathhouse. This was not Herod's private bathhouses. There are two other bathhouses here. I would tell you this is Turkish baths, only these were baths before they were Turks. So the Turks actually just kind of mimicked the Rhodian baths. There are three. I'm not going to get into a whole discussion. I've watched tour guides. I used to come up here when I would finish a group or just have some free time. I just follow tour guides around. That's the best way to learn things. I once watched a tour guide spend an hour in here, which blows my mind. I just watch people drop. So I'm only going to give you 60 seconds worth, because to be honest, I think the reason you came with me was not to hear about how Herod built baths. But I did want you to feel the luxury. You know, this is what we're talking about. This is not Herod's private bath. This is not even the VIP bath. This is like, you know, the Lieutenant Governor General bath where they kept waiting. So this is the outer room. You came in out of the sun. There was cold water, culinarium, right? And they would throw solid air, and they would take this cold water and you would throw it over yourself. Okay? And you would like, unbelievable. Because walking into a hot bath in the sun is not pleasant. So first you cool yourself off. Okay? And you would sit on the benches here in cool air. It would be really cold, you know? Pour cold water. How they got the water cold is an interesting discussion for another time. But they kept the water running. And if you're from a hot day, if you poured this water, which is not cold water, over you, it would be cool. You can try it if you want, right? Then when you finished in here, kind of, you know, hang out, and you could see the original frescoes, but all the walls here were covered with this beautiful artwork. Right, no, this is the original. Yeah, you can see where the tiles used to sit. Yeah, this is original flooring from 2,000 years ago. Okay, this is original benches. Okay, that's why there's a walkway here, so you won't damage the archaeology. Okay, then you come in here, okay, and you come to the next room, okay? Alright, the solarium. And basically what happens in here, come on in. That just shows you how the water flows, but I'll get to that in a minute. Okay? These are original ceilings. Everything here is original. No, I'm sorry. They reconstructed the ceilings, but they patterned them with cement because they obviously wanted them to fall in.
Okay, everything right. Above the black line.
Right, exactly. Okay? Can you hear me? Come on in. Then you came in here, okay? And this was a little hotter. Okay? And they actually, you got heated up here. Okay, like a kind of sauna thing, whatever. If you look in that side room as you pass by, you won't understand it, and I once tried to explain this to a group, and I gave up because every single person had to go see. If you ever come here on your own, you read a book, you'll see how the water, one of the mysteries here is where did the water come from? How did they get all this water? So there were a series of canals and whatever, but it still doesn't explain it. You're in the desert. So I'll get to that explanation at the end of the tour, but the canals that brought the water, they brought them here. There's an elaborate system there. Okay, but you can see it in here also, so you don't have to. So just real quick, so you can see the marks on the walls where the tiles used to be. So it's hard to imagine because it looks so old. But do you see here on the side? Okay, these are reconstructed. You see those? Okay, they're like, they have holes on the side. Okay, some of you may have noticed this in the old city, right? This was an ancient cooling system. Wind would come in and it would go through those narrow slits and it would pour through and come out the other side. Okay, and the wind would be rushed. Now, how did wind go through there? Look at the ceiling. Do you notice how the ceiling is rounded, which was not the case in the other room? Okay, so what happened? Right? Hot air rises. And the hot air rises, but it has nowhere to go. Okay? So, it gathers at the top and pushes the cooler air down the sides. And it creates this circular venting system for the steam. Okay? They had rocks. And they heated the rocks in fires. Okay? In the corner. And then they put the rocks, they rolled the rocks underneath the floor, which is why the floor is on pillars here, and the steam rose up. And you sat here, this was basically like a bath, it was like a sauna. Okay? And you came in and you hung out. And they could differentiate the temperature based on how much they heated the floor and how they directed the wind. The water came pouring in here to these hot rocks, and it came pouring in here from the side. In fact, they put plexiglass here so you could see that there's a water canal that used to come in here. And the water would come in. And they could control it. So there'd be nothing, and then they'd pour all this water in, and the steam would rise. Right? Okay? And that's where, and then they would go back out again. They would leave the steam out, or they could go back out and cool themselves off again, however they wanted to do it.
How is the wind going through those little holes?
Because when the water comes in, it creates a current. Now the hot air that's here wants to rise.
Right.
So some of it gets sucked up into those holes on both sides. Look, it's all around the wall.
Yeah.
Flows around the walls and then comes out of the holes. So you've got hot, and then they bring in water, and you get this cool burst of air on you, it cools you down, and then the steam raises you. It's a brilliant system. And in the book Masada, by the way, you can read, there's like a whole paragraph on how this bathhouse worked, which I'm sparing you, like I said, but there's a lot to say here. But I just wanted you to get a sense of this luxury of the contrast between the battle of the zealots and the life of luxury. Same thing, you see that?
Yeah.
The reason that war was that way, good catch, is because Herod figures, where's the best place for them to catch him and kill him? In the bathhouse. So he had an elaborate system of protection for the bathhouses. And this is one of them. There was a guard position at the end of that wall. And if anybody would attack, they got so narrow that only one guy could go through. Same thing as what we saw in the old city, and that protected it, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's the original tile. Yep, original, 2,000 years old. Everybody drink. As soon as he finishes, we'll go in there. But I'll tell you a quick... Okay, so let me just fill it in. So De Silva comes to the edge of the camp, and they play that bowling for dollars game. He tries a second time, they do the same thing. Then he brings archers up, and he brings the archers up to the edge of the snake path. Now realize, this is a Roman military doctrine. There's a system. First you do this, then you do that, and then you do this, right? They bring up a tortoise shell. Now, a tortoise shell was a particular type. I have a picture of it. I'll show you later. They had shields that were sort of like curved, and they were shaped like long rectangles. And what they did, you can see this, by the way, in the movie Gladiator, I think. You hold up the shield like this, and the guy next to you holds his shield up like this, and you have this kind of roof of shields, and you move up underneath, right? So that's a very difficult thing. What's the problem? The problem is you're going up a snake path like this. It doesn't work. Okay? Because picture that you're like this, and everybody's got their shields in front of them, the front is open. And if they put their shields like this, the top is open. Elazar ben Yair knows this. So he does a brilliant thing. He has four or five soldiers who are at the top. When they see the tortoises coming, okay, they shoot some arrows, and he tells them to aim for the shields. Okay? He wants them to hit the shields. He doesn't want them to succeed. They hit the shields. The Romans think they've got it down, right? They start moving forward more quickly. At a certain point, Ben Yair gives them a signal, and the five men run. So it looks like they're successful. They get up again to the point right below the walls, and all of a sudden, okay, 50 archers. You have to understand what it means to be an archer. You remember that drop. You've got an arrow, and it's got either stone or iron, mostly stone, on the end. You take a piece of wood with a heavy piece of stone, okay, and just throw it off the mountain, and it's weighted, okay, and it's got tips at the back, so it circles. So that when it hits you, it bores in, okay, and you let it drop 30, 40 feet. That sucker's going to knock you out. And if it hits any part of your body, it's going to either break your bones or pierce you. So now 50 archers at the same time throw 50 of these arrows down. Okay, only this time, they're not aiming for the shields. So it goes under the shields. Now imagine you've got this whole thing and the guys in back fall backwards because they're just missing these arrows and they land on their friends and all of a sudden this whole thing is in disarray. And the worst sight that Josephus describes the Silver Seas is a row of grinning defenders. And at that point, the Silver realizes he's in trouble. They knew exactly what he was going to do. They were waiting for it. They sucked him into a trap. The issue is not the 20 or 30 Roman legionaries who are now lying dead on the snake path. The issue is all the other men who are watching this. And that's what leads him to realize that he has to bring in the big guns. So he begins to build a siege wall. And for however long it takes him to build a siege wall, 8 months, 9 months, 10 months, there's no fighting. There's just siege.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.